All right. Have you got five flavor picks and some other shit going on?
Interestingly, no.
Well, that's the point of this episode.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I know. I'm just interestingly, no. You'll find out.
Okay. Welcome to Magic the Flavoring, the Magic the Gathering podcast, where we talk about all things magic, flavor design, and lore. I'm so sorry, and I'm your host, Andy Mann.
Oh, hello, I'm not sorry, I'm Nathan Cancel.
It is 20 to 10 at night, and we've had a couple of drinks.
Back to back episodes, bitches.
And this
Let's
is.
Go.
Oh, God, stop calling everyone bitches. This is the second episode. I mean, it's not really a batch record. I listen to some podcasts where the batch record is like five because they're all going on holiday.
This Game Grumps do it like time. Six episodes at a time, man. They record all day and then just spread it out across 2 months. You know, we're
so this
fine.
Is our
legit.
Double record. But I just instantly just we're doing flavor picks.
we are
flavor picks.
Good
this
job,
is very
buddy.
Confusing for people that didn't listen to the last episode. This episode is going to come out like a week or a week and a bit after the last one that we recorded, and they're like going, what the fuck is wrong with Andy? Can he just get his shit together? Like,
uh-huh,
whatever. We don't even have a Patreon. You don't pay for this, shut up.
Yeah, who needs to complain?
We get people asking us whether we should have a, but like they're like, we want to have a Patreon. It's like,
just guys, send us money direct to our account. DM
oh no,
us.
Like if I was doing a Patreon, I'd do like tier one, 1p, tier two, 2p. Do you know what I mean? I can't take people's money. I don't
what
know.
Are we offering at tier one and tier two?
Well,
to
yeah,
only
well,
offer
yeah,
a penny and two and tuple.
Well, I just thought it'd be funny. I thought it'd be funny if it was like tier one, 1p, we give you a shout on the podcast and thanks very much. Tier two, 2p. We give you a shout out on the podcast and thank you very much. Also, you spend double. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's not
okay,
even worth
it. I was going to say, like, a shout out's definitely worth a penny, for surezies. I just don't want to, I don't know if I want to express the usernames that our patrons would give us, you know? Like, at least, like, Spice 8 Rack has things like, you know, trans rights and human rights. What if we get, like, I'm a filthy little, you know?
Okay, we are doing flavor, anyway. Blah, 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 blah. We are doing flavor picks for Brothers War.
Brothers War, yeah.
You know the drill. You know what we're about with these flavor pick episodes. Mm. We're not like the other flavor pick episodes of other peoples who do this. We do things in a stupid manner. So it's all about the art. It's all about flavor text. It's about batches of cards, individual cards, basically just five broad things that we thought was lovely and flavorful about the set. And for a set that is just oozing with old school flavor, this is a biggie. I know this sounds like I've said that about a lot of sets, but this is like, this is the big one because it's a throwback set. What do you think?
I think throwback sets are really tough. I feel like this is maybe the first one they've done like properly in terms of like they've accepted, oh yeah, we were past this point in time and now we're doing it again and we realize we're doing it again. So how do we do it again, but better? Mm. And that's the thing from a Hasbro point of view and a Wizards point of view, right? Is it's not like, oh, how do we develop the narrative in terms of sets from the last set? How do we I mean, I'm sure there are people within the teams, the design team, the development team and all that kind of thing that are definitely having that as their focus. But from a, like a business point of view, it's like, hey, we're just doing that period in Magic again.
Yeah.
Make it make money. You know, and I think I genuinely think, and I had massive amounts of like you know, I doubted their ability.
You had reservations.
To perform massive amounts of reservation. And I think from a narrative point of view and from a set point of view, design wise, I think they're knocked out of the park and I kind of
Yes, thank you.
I don't want to give them that satisfaction.
I agree.
It's such a good set, man. It's a really good
phenomenal
set.
Phenomenal set. And everything as someone who, unlike you, and I know I've said this a couple of times on the lead up to this set coming out, who wasn't as around during all of this period of Magic history wise, and that's why they're bringing it back. And you know, they're sort of going, look, here are these stories. They are making them accessible. We've done our story reviews. We've spoken about it at length of how, like, you don't need to be an older Magic player to understand this older lore now, or at least the huge chunks of it. I got this kind of weird nostalgia for a time period of Magic that I haven't played.
That you weren't even around in, right?
Yeah. That's and the there are a couple of my individual flavor picks will kind of, I don't know. I don't know if it will explain it, because it's hard to articulate that kind of a feeling, right? That kind of a nostalgia. But we all know, we all understand. Speaking as someone who really doesn't, I'm not a nostalgic person within my own life, and it kind of runs me cold a little bit. I don't like talking about stories about, like, you know, oh, remember when we were at school? It's like, yeah, but we're here now.
Yeah, the member berries aren't so tasteful to you.
I'm not to me.
Which I think is kind of really good. I think it holds things in appropriate regard. I think it's very easy for you to go, oh yeah, I remember this being a really cool thing, and it makes you kind of forget all of the typical standardized, like, points of critique, you know. Yeah. You just go, oh yeah, there's that cool throwback, doesn't matter about the rest of it. Like Dominaria the set kind of had the similar a similar potential for failing, right? Where they're trying to go, hey guys, remember this set, and everyone's like, no. And it could have failed, and it didn't. It was like, oh, remember this set,
2018 was sick. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, like, the new players were like, oh shit, yeah, I didn't even know that was around back then. That's cool. And the newer players were like, oh man, like, this is, like, I didn't even know you were going to throw that back. It's like Time Spiral, the set. Every single card in that set was a throwback or a callback to something. If you don't know it, that's just because you weren't playing during that time. It was relevant to someone else. And that's what a throwback set should feel like, right? Is it should be a homage, it should be a celebration, it should be a callback, it should be all of those things. And I feel like this set, for a standard set, did it all right. I think it did it all right.
I will say, I think it's interesting you mentioned Time Spiral Remastered, because I sort of feel like that was my watermark for me personally. Again, it was a very popular set, and I know lots of people who absolutely adored it. You've just said how much you liked it. For me, that is the one where it's maybe just a bit too much into the kind of nostalgia pool.
Well, I don't mean Time Spiral Remastered. I meant the original Time Spiral.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, Time Spiral, Plane of Chaos, Future Sight. Time Spiral, the set original, was the throwback forward of it. Yeah. Every single card was... I mean, I feel like Time Spiral Remastered, I agree with you a bit hashed. This isn't that.
I mean, a lot of people like Time Spiral Remastered. But anyway, we digress. We're talking about Brothers War. We have so much Phyrexia to get through. I know when we first broke about Dominaria United, we were like, cool, Dominaria United, Brothers War. Phyrexia will be one, March of the Machines, or whatever way around they're doing that. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've got so much to get through. And I'm two sets in, technically, into this kind of mini Magic arc in terms of sets, like this kind of conjoined arc. I'm not bored of it at all. This is so my jam. Mm. Everything about the visuals, all the types of cards, is just, you know, firing on all cylinders for me. I think a couple of episodes I described my sort of love for sort of, you know, mech punk or diesel punk, or however you want to call it, steampunk, whatever kind of category you think this falls into, they all blur. This is really, really working for me. And a lot of my picks surround that aspect of it. And some of them are the characters. I will say, for a set, and we've had this in recent sets as well, for a set that has so many characters that are really relevant, not many of mine are those characters flavor-wise. I don't know about
interesting.
You.
Interesting. Mine's a very interesting selection. Because,
oh, well, as long as you think it's interesting, you're going to have to elaborate.
Why
go
do you call
you
me
go.
Out on this shit? Because the whole point is, right, is like, I really
struggled
to
find... Because I've known you for 12 years.
Yeah, I've got one that's a very obvious, like, of course he was going to talk about this pick. And then a couple of the others, I'm like, this isn't a one-card pick. This is like a 6 to 8-card pick. Because
and they're not part of a cycle,
about,
like, oh, lands
not necessarily, but, you know, like, as in, sometimes a flavor pick isn't an individual card, it's a series of cards that all convey the same message.
Yeah,
and this
I've,
is
been,
a
I've been doing
that
this podcast
very
with you
well.
For 2.5 years. I know the jam, I get
yeah.
it.
And some of the picks, like, you know, we've seen, and you know, cats out of the bag, there are like 3 different representations of both Urza and Mishra, 4 if you include the backsides,
well, 5 like, if you include the commander decks.
Exactly, right? Like, so there's like a, we're showing a period of history. This isn't right now this is happening. This is them when they were young, when they were middle-aged, when they were older. We've seen them at their heyday that you know about. We've seen them in their youth that you might not have known about. Like, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in this set that you can pick flavor out of. And I found, like, as much as I wanted to find, like, the micro, like, the individual card that I was like, oh, this conveys this perfect one specific thing, I find that much harder to gain, especially as, like, a modern player. Like, I've been playing for years, fine, but I'm a modern player. I'm playing now, and I find that it's much easier to grab an individual bit of flavour from a set like Therios Beyond Death or Kaldheim or even, like, you know, Eldrain than it is a set like this, because I feel like it's hearkening to a player that wasn't playing back then. So all I can do is try and reinterpret their cards, which are reinterpretations of the old sets anyway, because I wasn't playing back during Antiquities. I have cards from Antiquities, and I wasn't unaware of Magic back then. I just wasn't entrenched like I am now. So a lot of these, you know, deep cuts might be a bit too deep for me, and some of the light cuts might go over my head. And I feel like, for me, and I'm going to say this way ahead of time, is that I find all of the big random 7+ casting cost mechs,
whatever. We are so divided on this whole
point, right? And this is why we both do this together, because I find that there was a few things that were low to the ground that really landed, and some of the other things are a little bit like, I'm sure there were giant mechanized things fighting each other, but I'm not playing Attack on Titan, the mech set. I'm playing the Brothers War. I want to see the Brothers and the characters around the Brothers, you know? And they did both of those things very well. So there was a half and half with this set, right? Half of the set was, I feel like, for some people, and half of the set was for other people. It just depends on how you divide
yourself. No, I am completely playing anime mech series. That's exactly what this set is for me.
And I feel like they had to kind of do this, right? They had to provide both something for the modern audience as well as something for the entrenched audience. And for a set, that's a really hard thing to do, and I don't think they failed. And that's the thing, is just because I really responded to half the set and you really responded to half the set doesn't mean that either of those sets, either of those halves are invalidated by the other. And that's what I'm really glad that we've both gone for, because I was wondering, I was like, I wonder what he's gone for, because I've gone for what I feel like are really obvious choices. And if you
know from outside podcast conversations that I've not even ones I've been a part of, but again, one of our many Magic WhatsApp groups, you've mentioned two cards that are a flavor pick of mine, but I know you're going to pick them. So let's just start with those.
Cool. Let's really hope that I didn't not pick those. I mean, I'm sure we can talk about this at the end anyway, but yeah, cool. I mean, let's get into it, right? There's going to be plenty of us to talk about.
All right. Well, how about let's talk about Urza and Mishra then?
Yeah, right, exactly. Cool. Right, so Urza, Power Stone Prodigy, Mishra, Excavation Prodigy. Yeah, you might be thinking, let's go for the mythics, let's go for the rares. No, fuck that bullshit. Let's give me the original characters. The couple that should have been a partnership, I don't know why they're not.
Best Friends? Is that the mechanic from the Stranger Things Secret Lair?
And they should only be partners together as such, exactly, yeah. And friends forever. And the problem is that Mishra and Urza canonically we're not friends forever.
Could they have changed it? They could have changed it to brothers. These two characters are brothers and can only be brothers with each other.
It's fine, it's good. Like my last point about these two cards, which art by Donato Giancola, pronounced that awfully, but it's a panorama. The two of them are both fixing up the Ornithopter that they fly to the caves of Koilos, where they find the Might Stone and the Weak Stone, and they battle each other, and eventually Takassia dies, and eventually everything of the Brothers War comes from these two characters. And the reason why I find it such an interesting thing is we see them as boys, we see them as men, and we see them as warlords, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not going to talk about either of the last two, because I feel like I could talk about for another half hour about all of the ways that mechanically the progression of their characters works from mechanicals versus flavor point of view. The two one I want to focus on is Urza and Mishra individually as 3-mana cost uncommon legends. So 2 and a blue for Urza, Power Stone Prodigy, Human Artificer, 1/3 Vigilance, generic tap, draw a card, discard a card. Whenever you discard one or more artifact cards, create a tapped Power Stone token. This ability triggers only once per turn. Mishra, Excavation Prodigy, 2 and a red, 2/1 haste, legendary human artificer, generic, tap, discard a card, draw a card. Whenever you discard one or more artifact cards, add red. This ability only triggers once each turn. Now, one of the things that really annoys me now looking at both of them is that Urza doesn't have flavor text, whereas Mishra does.
I thought you were going to say that. I fully agree. Fucking annoying. But
take away the reminder text from the Power Stone token, and then you could have added flavor text to it, but Urza has way more story relevance placed to him anyway. I feel like this was the set for Mishra to get a bit more diversity. We see a little bit more about who he is, why he is what he is. So the flavor text being, while Urza read books, Mishra learned to read the desert itself, I feel like gives an extrapolation on his character where Urza's already had plenty placed to him.
Well,
anyway,
also, if we count this almost, because Meld is obviously a mechanic in this set, and Urza and Mishra have Meld cards, if we were to treat this as a Meld of two cards together, because it is the panorama art, right? then that is a flavor text that applies to both of them. So I kind of feel like it works. Yeah,
exactly. And it's also, so this is, so I'm going to work backwards, because when I started writing about these two cards, I tried to talk about the differences mechanically about them. And then my final summarization was that this is a perfect example of how red and blue as artificers are presented as mechanical differences within the game, right?
Mm.
Red and blue have always both been artificers. It's been really hard to kind of define between the two of them as to why they are what they are. I also really like the fact that Urza survives the combat between the two if they were to attack and block each other.
Yeah, that's really clever. I was like, well, hang on, one's a 1-3 and one's a 3-1. Like, do you know what I mean? It kind of is weird that they don't mirror the power toughness, but actually the storytelling of who's more powerful in the end really works.
Because Mishra has more attacking power, but is quite, you know, weak as a human, whereas Urza has more staying power and has a little bit of attack, but that's enough to kill Mishra if they were to get into battles of kids. Urza is exactly 2 days shy of a year older than Mishra, because Mishra's born in the last day of the year, whereas Urza's born in the first day of the year. So it's 2 days shy of a year difference. So Urza is naturally, you know, a little bit bigger, a little bit, you know, stronger, blah, 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 whatever, whatever. But the thing I like is that they both do the same thing, essentially, which is drawing and discarding. And if you were to discard an artifact, if you were to learn knowledge on an artifact, Urza creates a more permanent but more limited form of mana, being a Power Stone artifact token. So you can't use it for anything other than activated abilities and artifact spells. Mishra creates two red. You can use that on anything, but you can only use it right now. You can't use that permanently. So one of them's creating a permanent source of limited mana, whereas one of them's creating a less permanent source of generic mana. And I say generic in the wrong way, because it's red. And it's also interesting to think that back then, There weren't many magicians, there weren't many wizards in the set, right? Most of them were artificers specifically because magic wasn't a thing. The third path that Felden and Loran kind of formed was magic, you know? You had Urza's side, Mishra's side, and then you had the third path, which was magic, which is kind of interesting. I like the fact that one of them has vigilance because Urza's more contemplative. I like the fact that Mishra's more impulsive, so he has the haste effect. It's also really interesting to show that Urza likes to gain the knowledge before discarding the knowledge, you know, drawing a card, then discarding, whereas Mishra discards first, gets rid of things, doesn't want to know to draw the card. It shows the difference between rummaging and looting that red and blue have always had the kind of like antithesis to. In fact, they mirror each other's mana costs as well, is fantastic. And it kind of also flows a little bit into their further in life. You've got Urza's rebuff and Mishra's onslaught. And I said this to you slightly earlier in the before we even recorded, where I don't have 5 specific picks, because this is kind of like pick 1.5. Urza's rebuff, 1 blue, choose 1, counter target spell or tap up to 2 target creatures. The flavor text being, as usual, my brother's maneuvers are brash and impulsive, Urza. Mishra's onslaught, 3 and a red, choose 1, create 2 1/1 colorless soldier artifact creature tokens, or creatures you control get +2/+0 until end of turn. Ha! Urza has underestimated my strength yet again, Mishra. Now, this shows perfectly the difference between their perspectives. Obviously, Urza's rebuff being a counter spell, being a blue spell. Mishra's Onslaught being a red spell, it requires less red, being 1 single red source as opposed to Urza's double blue cost. The fact that Urza's spell either taps the 2 creatures that Mishra's Onslaught produces, or the fact that if you're doing the other thing of giving all your creatures +2/+0, Urza's spell counters it directly. Clearly, Urza is the stronger than the two in this one-on-one situation, which obviously, in the grand scheme of the story, Urza succeeds where Mishra doesn't, because he, you know, detonates the Silex and ascends. But Mishra in this set seems to have as much, if not equal, power. It's just in the nuance of the cards themselves, Urza clearly comes out on top. It would not be a flavor win if Urza was a 1-2 and Mishra was a 2-1.
Yeah, their end points of Mishra to try and overcome his brother having to meld with a Phyrexian, having to meld with a dragon engine with the use of Phyrexia, so he betters himself to try and beat Urza, whereas Urza, you could argue, with the Silex, bests his brother and resultingly becomes transcendent.
And some more, exactly, yeah. Right? Like, clearly, and what's funny, right, is that I'm not going to speak about this in my flavor picks because I haven't gone into the rares and then the mythics, but Mishra's flip side can destroy a planeswalker. So technically, from a mechanical flavor point of view, the card Mishra melded is stronger than Urza melded, because Mishra can destroy him and then do 2 other effects, which maybe again is a flavor fail, which is why I've not transcended this kind of, you know, this theory beyond.
I think for a limited environment, even down to like say the even for like the pre-release, where the pre-release kits this time were Urza versus Mishra, like, you know, how like in Ravnica Allegiance and Guilds of Ravnica, you picked your guild. This one was like you picked your side of the war. So I think from a play perspective, they needed them to play off a little bit better against each other. But
yeah, exactly. And I genuinely think that Urza as a combination is probably stronger ostensibly than the Mishra one. It just happens to me that the Mishra meld happens to counter the other one. Again, it's quite nice to show this constant battle between the two of them. Even if you look throughout all of their iterations, the fact that the Might Stone for Urza creates a greater affinity, can strengthen and empower, whereas Mishra's weak stone can depower and sap the energy of. You can notice this where in their rares, Mishra has a ward, sacrifice, a permanent. So all, if your opponent wants to kill your things, it takes them a cost. It weakens them. Whereas for Urza, it gives a benefit to all of your artifact creatures, +2/+2. You know, that's, and it permeates through all of their iterations. And I think this is a really cool set to show for those players that didn't know. And again, Mishra only had like one card and it wasn't the best card. It was really awkward in Commander to give three different cards that you can go with. And I don't care. I'm building an Urza Mishra Partners deck. You can, I'm going to rule zero it, and if you're against that, come fight me. You know, it's not a fucking, it's not a stupid fucking Transformers, you know, legends. Like, whatever, fight me.
Do you know what? I'm not as down on the Transformers cards as I am all the other ones.
They're really good. I really wish I didn't like them as much. They are mechanically so cool. I think they're really good. That's a whole other time. I feel like we need to do a whole episode on the Transformers and also maybe Jumpstart, because I feel like the flavor in them are really, really cool. We'll see. But anyway, yeah, Mishra, Urza, three iterations. I think the uncommon ones are the best evidence of how they're different as characters and how their separation happened from initial point of view, and it's such a shame that they couldn't be together again. Maybe we'll see a what if universe at some point in the history of Magic going 20 years in the future of where the Brothers War didn't happen, they were aligned and they fought against Phyrexia together. Who the fuck knows? But I feel like they did a really, really good justice to showing how the Brothers started differently, and then their progressions were justifiable mechanically, you know, in the cards that were printed.
I agree. Some very nice high-minded stuff there. I really appreciate it. Lots of deep dives and very nuanced take on some well-designed cards. My first flavor pick is Liberator Urza's Battlethopter.
Yeah, great.
Because, you know, it's called Liberator, Urza's Battlethopter, and that's just the fucking coolest card name.
How is Battlethopter not so more ridiculous a word than it is? Because I accept it willingly.
It conveys this, so immediately, this is why this card is a flavor pick. Battlethopter, people understand battleship, right? Battleship is a very sort of, you know, and even in sci-fi, plus the real world
you
navy,
sunk
whatever.
By battleship.
Yeah, just everything about the word battle and whatever vehicle conveys a very, like, not just because people know what the word battle means, but in conjunction, it's a really good signifier to like a bulky, armored thing for war. If you play Magic, you know what thopters are, because thopters range from shit like Ornithopter, do you know what I mean? Yeah. To Battlethopter, do you know what I mean?
Well, it's a thopter assembly, you've got
everything, do you know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, it's all at once, these kind of very sort of weak kite-like flying machines, pardon me, to these sort of, you know, big hulking flying fortresses. And yeah, it's just amazing. So, Liberator Urza's Battlethopter. The fact that it's named as well. The fact that this is a legendary artifact creature and this could be your commander. It's just everything about it is just so great. Three generic. It's an artifact. Legendary artifact creature Thopter. Flash flying. You may cast colorless spells and artifact spells as though they had flash. Colorless spells as well as artifact spells.
Yep. Get those Eldrazi in there, motherfuckers.
Yeah, exactly. Like, ridiculous. Whenever you cast a spell, if the amount of mana spent to cast that spell is greater than Liberator Urza's Battlethopter's power, put a 1-1 counter on Liberator. They don't full name it in the third iteration on the card. It just ends with the word Liberator. Interesting. And it's a 1-2. Starts as a 1-2. So the Battlethopter itself is what the object is basically a command carrier for mech troops, right? So in the artwork by the phenomenal Ekaterina Burmak, whose rendering of this battle thopter is crazy good. It's this big hulking thopter with the big sails that you expect of that era of ship, with a giant face.
Why is there a face on it?
It's not even Urza's face.
Why is there a face on it?
With red eyes. It's so cool. And it's dropping off mechanized troops.
Commanding.
Right? Mm-hmm. So the flavor of the card is the more things you cast with its first couple of abilities, so the more like artifact troops is kind of the flavor of what you're putting down, because in this set you've got a load of mechs, right? The more mechs you play, the more power you get on the board, the bigger the Liberator becomes. So in retrospect, the more powerful the Battle Thopter is because of the amount of troops that it's putting down. Like, it's this really cyclical design that I think on some other cards makes it sort of like not work, but on this one it really does. It's called Urza's Battle Thopter Liberator. Just everything, I don't know. This is a very lowbrow flavor pick because it's just me going, cool. And this is the card that, because of the artwork, because of the era of Magic that we're looking at, because of just everything about it, this is the one that made me go, oh man, the Brothers War is so cool. Like, I wish I could
so
know more
cool,
about
dude.
It. Yeah. This is it. Big ship go burr. And it's not even that big. It's 3 mana and a 1/2, but it has heft to it in a weird way. I don't know. I think it's a great pick. I don't think I'll build a commander deck out of it. That doesn't justify it as not being flavorful.
Is it better than, you know, any of the other artifact offerings? Probably, because of the flash thing.
I think you'd have to build, because I've got a 5-color +1/+1 counter deck, because I got lazy and was like, I just want, and I thought my Kenrith was my commander, which is all at once a really basic choice, but I thought was a clever choice because of the abilities synergize with +1/+1. Anyway, I think if I'm building a +1/+1 counter deck, much to the chagrin of not being able to use any of my colored permanents, which are the reason I built a 5-color deck, I think this is the way I'd go. I think I'd do +1/+1 counter colorless artifacts. Yeah.
Yeah, I never felt anything close to that with any other colorless offerings. And I think it's a really cool generic offering, which it can be by itself a pretty good option as well, right? I don't think it's an ish. Mm. Cool. So, the Journey of the Silex.
Ooh, lovely.
So we joked about this, right, when they printed Khan's Silex, of like, oh, they're just going to print Urza's Silex? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're just going to do...
Doesn't Skeety have anything... a Silex?
Well, right, so this is the thing, right? Hang on. The Khan's Silex in Dominaria is the one before it was destroyed.
Yeah.
And that's the one that enters the battlefield tapped. Players can't play life to cast spells or activate abilities that are mana abilities. You know, the stopping Phyrexia little thing. I think we spoke about this in our favor highlights of Dominaria United. And then X tap, exile, Khan's Silex, destroy each non-land permanent with mana of value X or less, activate enemies of sorcery. Now, Urza's Silex, original Silex.
Zaylee doesn't have a Silex yet. It's Urza's Silex, yeah.
And there is a Golgothian Silex where you sacrifice it and you get rid of anything from the set of antiquities, I think, including lands. So I'm not going to check it up right now. It might be non-land. I can't remember. What I like about the two of them is they're essentially the same object, but based on who is using them, they have slightly different interactions.
Yeah.
Which... from a mechanical point of view, in terms of a mage, the Silex shouldn't have a different functionality, right? But in terms of a mage using the Silex, the circumstance of the moment should dictate that that artifact acts in a different fashion and reacts
in a different
fashion.
Yeah, because you're pouring yourself. Urza poured parts of himself into it to make it work.
Yeah, and the thing I liked about the whole fill it with the memories of the land... for artificers and people that didn't understand magic, that was just, they don't understand the words, but it basically says, fill it with magic. Because the memories of the land is tapping into your land, which is tapping into your mana base, which is filling it with mana, which is putting magic into it. During that time in the Brothers War, magic wasn't a thing, you know? The third path was only starting to come into effect. Hercule, you know, Loran, Felden, they all started to learn that you could be a magician. And it was only, and we spoke about this as well in our story retrospective of the original episodes, where Urza and Teferi are talking, and Teferi's talking to Urza, and he's like, I just, you know, I meditated, and I just put that energy into the Silex. It's like, yeah, that's called casting a spell, motherfucker. You might not know that's what that is, and because you're from an age of artifice, but that's what mages are, that's what magic is these days, you know, with... 6,000 years back in the present now. Like, you know, like that's what magic is. It's tapping into the ley lines and producing mana. So it's interesting to see that then for Urza Silex, the same amount of cost to pay for it, 3 generic, 2 white tap, exile Urza Silex. Each player chooses 6 lands they control and they destroy all other permanents, including lands. Activate only as a sorcery. Both things only activating as a sorcery. I like the idea that you have to put a concerted effort into it. You can't just do it on a whim. You know, it takes a specific amount of effort to get into and make happen. I like the fact that it takes white mana because we see from Urza, he starts as a blue mage and as he becomes the protector and then he becomes the... The prince of Krug, and then the Grand Protector. He starts adding white mana to himself, and it's almost the white mana that justice, that feeling of God, I've just lost my brother, you know, and I've lost everything, and the only way to fix this is to have this utilitarian apocalypse happen. I like the idea of for 2 white, the same cost as Wrath of God, you know, the same cost as Armageddon, the same cost as any normal white wrath spell. That's the thing that makes each player choose 6 land to destroy everything else. Yeah, it leaves a little bit of land behind. You know, 6 lands isn't insignificant in standard, but for Commander, that could knock people back 10 lands or so. And then also, when Urza Silex is put into exile from the battlefield, you may pay 2 mana, and if you do, you search your library for a Planeswalker card, reveal it and put it into your hand, then shuffle. This is Urza Ascending. This is Urza's Silex. Of course it has a different effect to Khan's Silex, because it's being interacted with by a completely different mage, for completely different reasons, at a completely different time. And normally I'd have big issues between, like, why do they cost different things to do different things? But the whole point, it's a tool. And it depends on who's using it as to the effect that you're going to get from it. We're not seeing Khan's Silex the potential it can have. We're now seeing Urza's Silex and the potential it did have. So of course it has a different effect because it's doing a different thing in the time that it's existed. Now, beyond that, again, this is why I push into why I don't have 5 favor picks, because this is only I only really have 3. The reason why this one extends longer is because Ashild's Intervention.
Yeah.
Single black, instant, until end of turn, target creature gets +2 and gains when this creature dies or is put into exile from the battlefield, return to its owner's hand. None of that matters. Flavor text, listen, Duck. And this is Ashnod talking to Tornos, Duck being the, you know, cutesy term that she referred to him as. Gix is everywhere, playing every side. Mishra won't listen, but perhaps Urza will. From that into Fateful Handoff, 3 and a black for a sorcery, draw a card equal to the mana value of target artifact or creature you control. An artifact gains control of that permanent. Flavor text, get the Silex to Urza at any cost. Tell him to fill it with memories of the land. Ashnod to Tornos. This is Ashnod, after they've reclaimed it, to give it back to Tornos to make sure it gets to Urza, because they knew it was the only way to stop Mishra. And the last little piece of this whole, like, flavor puzzle was the initial Loran's Escape. For a single white, target artifact or creature gains hexproof and indestructible in end of turn, scry 1. As Teresia's city burned, Felden pressed the Silex into Loran's hands and urged her to run. Hope ran with her. Now, in the grand scheme of things, the Silex is found by Felden, given to Loran as Teresia's city is burning. Loran escapes but gets caught by Ashnod. Ashnod ends up taking the Silex from her. As things progress, Ashnod then realizes that, you know, both Mishra's at fault, Urza's at fault, but the only way maybe to stop the Brothers' War and everything that's happening, because her copulation with Tornos, is to give the Silex to Tornos, get the Silex to Urza, and then obviously Urza detonates it and stops the Brothers' War, because at that point Mishra's, you know, completed and turned into the, you know, Phyrexian dragon engine construct thing and blah, blah. What I like about this is it shows the progression of the Silex. It's very interesting artifact, right? Because most people don't really know where it came from. It's even said in a recent story with Teferi that, like, every single nation has a different story about how it came to be and where it was founded from. And we get to see a little bit of how individual acts between these important characters, Loran and Felden, Ashnod and Tornos, you know, we get to see how important these little interactions were to get history to play out the way it did, to have history be how it is now. And the Silex, for the fact it does have such different interactions between Khan's Silex and Urza's Silex, it's not even the fact of it, it's the things that happened around it, the character interactions around it, and how that's presented within this story. There are 5 different cards within the set, I think, that if not more, that show the Silex and show the effect it has and the journey it's had. I mean, the Silex might be the most important character in terms of the Brothers' War, in terms of like how it affected everything going forwards. You know, the fact that Urza turned into a planeswalker and destroyed an entire continent, caused the Ice Age, all through the Silex. Now, this is a really important item, and I think as a card, fine, cool, yeah. So it's a Wrath, and it can get you, it can fetch you a Planeswalker. But the fact it's a 2WW Wrath, it's such a little wink and a nudge to Wrath of God, a little wink and a nudge to Armageddon. It's such a little wink and a nudge to being such a powerful, you know, a powerful artifact. Yeah. And I think it's funny that we mentioned, like, you know, oh, it's called Karn Silex. Do you reckon we're going to get Urza Silex or Saheeli Silex? Yeah, we probably are. And they did it. And they were
The side stories, they talk about Saheeli Silex, about being that Saheeli Silex is remake, exactly the same. Right?
But it's Karn a little Silex bit... is broken. Yeah. It's broken. It's destroyed. Yeah, and as you say, now there's a Saheeli Silex. Do we get that in the next set? I don't know.
Well, no, we will, because that will be the Silex that's used to destroy everything.
Uh-huh. And I think that's really cute. If it's not the same CMC, I'll be really, really annoyed, because three CMC is quite nice. It'll be interesting to see how her version is used.
Well, you know, because she's a better artificer than Urza.
Oh, absolutely.
All you Reddit 100%. Losers. It'll be two mana, because she's more powerful. Efficient.
Exactly.
Cool. Yet again, you're so clever. You're so insightful about Magic, and your flavor picks really reflect that. And I'm just so honored to be on the same podcast as you. My next flavor pick are the full art basic lands,
and I really
like them, because, you know, much like your deep dive into the history of the Silex and majors pouring themselves in and the nuance and the storylines and everything, I loved these full art lands because they've got big fucking robots on them.
Big Mac
stuff.
Yeah,
and I like big fucking robots.
My only comment on this, on these lands, is holy Christmas, because I had no idea these existed before I looked up. I looked up the Brothers War fucking. I opened it up on Mythic Spoiler. I got to the bottom and I nearly shat myself. I was like, holy fuck! Haven't I bought this set? The basics are insane. They're so cool.
Oh gosh! Holy Christmas!
Holy Christmas!
Yeah, so we get two full art basic lands for each colour. And oftentimes in recent Magic, they've been tempted towards giving like two artists sort of reign over one half of each. And they do it with the non-full art basics as well. For example, although they'll thematically split them apart. For example, in Neon Dynasty, they had one artist do all of the modern Kamigawa, influenced by the Kami, and then the other artist, they have the Kami world influenced by modern, and like kind of the playoff for all that kind of thing. Even as far as back as Strixhaven, they had, you know, the wilds and the realm lands. Not that, you know, all the way back makes it sound like it was ages ago, but you know what I mean, this has been around like for a lot of modern Magic. They've not done it this time. They've given each full art land, so 10 total, to a different artist, and just their interpretation of, like, just make a giant fucking robot in whatever situation. And yeah, and we do. And they're all amazing. I can't really individually go through them because they're all just so unique and wonderful. I think my favourites have to be the islands, just because of the way that they're designed. I'm a big fan of the film Pacific Rim. Do you like Pacific Rim? It's just Guillermo del Toro just going, big robots.
Let's do Gundam. Let's do Evangelicom.
Drift compatible, baby. I love it. And yeah, like the islands give you massive Pacific Rim vibes just because of where they're set.
The
I don't
water
know, there's no
pouring
big
off of, which one was the one that I'm looking at now? The Brian? I think it's the Brian one? Brion? Man, the quality of the picture isn't great. But the one where, like, it's the big bulky torso and all the water's just draining off of them. Oh my God.
Robin Olusen.
Yep, that's it. Really bad. Yeah, exactly. That one. Like, there's so many where, like, you can feel the sound as they step, as the steam effervesces off of them. exactly. It's so cool.
I mean, that trailer for Pacific Rim, that was one of the classic, like, Christopher Nolan bois, like, rip-off trailers. It's the scene where you've got there on the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, and you know it's about to be destroyed, because it always is. And then the kaiju just out the mist swings across. And I remember watching that trailer, and it just goes...
I remember that now,
It's so good.
It's so good.
I mean, that's what these lands do. They go... Bwah.
Yeah, but you're supposed to feel like that, right? And I said this at the beginning of the episode, I didn't like it, but the reality of it is my little heart and my soul goes, this is super cool, this is super awesome, let's go big Gundam, you know.
What I really like about these lands as well, in a kind of more design choice kind of way, is that a lot of times, because we've got full art lands are now not just Zendikar, and they haven't been for a very, very long time, and they do have big swings with the lands, and they do tell narratives a lot of the time. the Hour of Devastation versus Amonkhet lands showed the exact same scenes before and after the Hour of Revelation, or Hour of Devastation, sorry. The full art lands for Theros Beyond Death obviously had all the Nyx sort of mana symbol lands, so that was completely meta within like the game of Magic. It was a big old swing, blah 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 blah. The stained glass windows one from Dominaria United. So they have had these big swings, but a lot of the time, even the Nyx symbol lands, they have purposefully, and to their credit, made them lands that could potentially fit in a lot of different decks with a lot of different themes or whatever, because you want them to be accessible. You want your forest to look like a forest, whether you're playing it in like a fucking elves deck or like a dinosaurs deck or whatever. And the times where they have gotten specific with lands in a narrative way or like a time and place way, and the one I'm using is the Ixalan basics, where every Ixalan basic had a little Jace kind of running around the island that he found himself on. I didn't like those because I was like, they're so specific, what are you going to use those in other than an Ixalani Jace deck? Like, I kind
sure,
of
yeah,
if you're fair. Thinking about it in that way, which is the way that I think about lands, and I think a lot of people think about lands, and you want your tie-ins to your decks, if you're using them in an EDH deck or a themed like a Mon deck or whatever, you will pick up on those little signifiers. Like my fucking Zavai deck, all of the lands are the two basic lands, which are the Prismari campus lands, right? Because they're all the campuses. So you do find those little signifiers, and they are specific, but they can be fantasy generic. These are definitely big fucking robots. So unless
big
you're doing
fucking robots,
unless
yeah.
you're doing like a mech deck or a Dominaria deck, or even if you just want to have like, hey, I want my lands to have robots because I think they're cool, but they do stand out.
You make a Brea deck and you need four out of the fucking five colors of mana in your basics. Where else do you go but these giant mech artifices?
They're so specific if you are being thematic that I think that it's what they're needed for. Like,
yeah,
why can't we just get some robot
rather
lands?
A disservice for sure.
Yeah, I think it really works. Yeah. Love them. Big robots. Cool lands. They're all great.
Yeah, I'm glad you called them out. Because, as I said, I scrolled down to the bottom and I was like, how the hell did I not see these the first time they came out? They have such gravitas. So cool. And again, I'm glad that, as you said before, like normally they give this all to one artist. I'm really glad they spread them out because it gives a lot of people an opportunity to do a lot of cool different things all within the same similar theme. So yeah, super cool. Right, we've been talking long enough. Gix, motherfucker.
Yeah, here it is. Gix!
He got his Gix. Boys, let's fucking go. This is like my speedrun, like, expulsion. He's here. My boy's here at last. I'm going to go straight into the mechanics, and then we can talk about spousing about it, because, I mean, I feel like there are some things that might be criticised and some things that might not be criticised. The fact that he's got a Phyrexian watermark as well. Hello. Snuck that in. Love the fact they're willing to do watermarks outside of set context, as it were. Being like, well, he's a Phyrexian, why wouldn't we give him the Phyrexian watermark? Exactly, why wouldn't you? You know, I feel like if you have a Ravnican Planeswalker, give them their individual... shit, what are they called? Guild. Give them their guild watermark outside of the plane.
Yeah, like, outside the guild packs. That's cool. Yeah.
Right? Why not? Why not? So Gix, Yawgmoth Praetor. One black, for a 3/3. Legendary creature, Phyrexian Praetor. Now, before we go any further, he's a Phyrexian Demon Praetor, okay? And no one can tell me fucking different. You can fit that shit in there. Why the hell isn't he a Phyrexian Demon Praetor is beyond me.
They can fit Asmirano, Mardy, Kadice, and Akorda Karr.
Right,
they
but they
that,
can't
yeah.
put Demon into your fleet. Whatever. Okay, cool, fine, whatever. Anyway, whenever a creature deals combat damage to one of your opponents, its controller may pay one life if they do draw a card. Four, black, discard X cards. Exile the top X cards of target opponent's library. You may play lands and cast spells from among the cards exiled this way without paying their mana costs. So,
yeah.
Before I get into the mechanics of it, one of my biggest things with this is the interesting interpretation of how Gix looks across the artists. Now, we're looking back all the way at Pete Ventures, right? During the Vanguard artwork.
I shit you not, I've got the Vanguard card on my phone right now. Okay, yeah, sorry, go on, sorry.
But it's one of those things, right? Is back then, it was considered to be quite goofy. And I'm glad that they didn't just go all the way in and just keep it at the same way it was before, right? Because they've given a few different artists the opportunity to... why isn't this by... Oh, right, by name. Yeah, I want to do it by release date. There we go. So I just scryfling the shit out of this.
Yeah,
right,
big up Scryfall, by the way. You're awesome.
Yeah, go lore, go Gix, put it in release date, descending order, boom, sorted. So Pete Venture did a couple, right? So he has his original Vanguard artwork, and he also did Oppression. Now, yeah. Do I think that that interpretation of Gix is a little bit kind of too twee for the modern Magic audience?
The Power Rangers.
So it's a little bit, right? And I like it for what it is, and what I like is they haven't really taken that away. Even if you look at, like, Bereavement, they kind of stuck to, but they give it like an illusion, illusion of his kind of like semi-sinew, semi-bone, semi-mechanical completion, which is kind of what Phyrexia was going for back then. They didn't really know how to do it properly. I feel like Elishnorn is the perfect, complete version of like mixing bone and sinew. The metal of her character doesn't really come through as much as it does on some of the other Praetors. No. In fact, I'd say one of the biggest arguments against New Phyrexia in general is the metal artifice side of them doesn't really come through very strongly.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the biggest things against the New Phyrexians.
Yeah. If we're talking from an artistic point of view, as opposed to, like, you know, like their in-world like indoctrination, then
I kind of like their interplanar indoctrination of all the things. But you know what? They're just not metal enough.
You know, well, this is why I quite like Dominaria United, because the completed like Phyrexian sleeper agents and stuff, because it was Shouldred, seemed to be a bit more crudely artificey. Like they had like random pipes,
a bit more
and
intestine-y.
Tubes. Yeah, like kind of protruding naturally from like from everywhere, which kind of showed that they weren't as good as nature. Whereas you look at Vorinclex and you go, but that's just an animal. How is he an artifact? And obviously, none of the Praetors are artifact creatures. Which is, again, maybe an argument for another day, and maybe we'll talk about this in the future, about how, like, what's the difference between a Phyrexian zombie as opposed to a Phyrexian artifact creature, you know, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, we're moving away from the point. Artistically, I feel like Gix has had a very specific view, right, of a very specific art direction. And then as we've come towards, like, modern times, and this, especially this set, because it's the only set we've really kind of looked at, this has been, like, cat out of the bag, like, everyone's been demanding Gix for years,
yeah.
For years and years and years. And I'm glad they did him the justice they did in this set. It made him feel so important. And if you look at Mishra and the reason why he did what he did and the reason why what happened is because he kept getting infected with these fucking dreams of Phyrexia and these. And there's even a card in the set of dreams of sinew and steel or oil and steel or something. I can't remember exactly what it's called.
Oil and steel.
And the idea is, that he's being impregnated with these thoughts of Phyrexia ever since he went to the Caves of Koilos. And Gix is the predominant person, you know, or the predominant Praetor that's been stuck in Phyrexia for millennia. Like, I mean, the millennia that spanned between the Thran Empire and Yawgmoth originally, and then what we're seeing in the original Brothers War, is like 3,000, 4,000 years or something like that. And, you know, Phyrexia's been developing since then. Yawgmoth's descended into the inner circle of Phyrexia. Gix has been developing as a fucking demon Praetor. You know, lots of things have been happening in Phyrexia before they open the doors to it, come back into Dominaria at the end of the Brothers' War. Like, we see this in the conversation between Teferi and Urza as well, of where Urza's like, oh no, that's the first time you've faced them, but they are coming back, and they're coming back now. Mm. You know, and even Urza was like, oh, I don't really want to have to deal with it. I've only just started dealing with this. I thought we'd fixed it, and I've got to deal with this for the rest of my life. Like, the gravitas of that is huge. But one of the things I really like is the fact that you see someone like, you see it in Gix's Caress, for example. I'm going to scroll back here, sorry, a second. So you see, Gix's Caress by Ignatius Booty. What a fucking name, by the way. Good job, Ignatius. What a name. It's really menacing. It's kind of got this kind of like almost like alien kind of quality to it. And then if you move further into Painful Quandary, a reprint by David Palumbo, it's almost like the human xenomorph from, I think it's Alien 3. I can't remember if it's Alien 3 or Aliens, where the queen makes like a human xenomorph kind of hybrid thing. And it's kind of got that human skull in the face, but then their skull extends backwards. Because that's kind of what I look at.
Is it not Alien Resurrection?
That might be Resurrection. Yeah, the one that gets sucked out through the tiny...
Original Ripley dies at the end of Aliens 3, and then...
Yeah, and there's a little hole that they make in the window, and right, and then the entire alien gets sucked out through it. Yeah. So that's what I feel like is happening in Alien, in Painful Quandary. Like the face of it feels demonic, it feels skull-like. And the reason I mention this is because I think it's actual artwork, you know, Gix, Yawgmoth, Praetor. I don't know if it gives the same justice in terms of menace, in terms of like body horror, in terms of being frightening, but in terms of like decadence, You know, in terms of grandeur, I feel like Gix Yawgthmoth Praetor is a really good representation of like that kind of deification that Gix managed to get. That kind
yeah,
of
it does
excellence
have a very sort
you
of
wanted
like,
in this character.
It does have a very religious art sort of pose to it, I think.
Yeah.
Also the name Yawgthmoth Praetor. Like,
Praetor, kind of, yeah. And everyone's bowing in front of him, and he looks massive in comparison to the humans in front of him. Like, maybe being a 3-3 isn't representative properly, but I feel like being a 3-mana 3-3, so he gets on the board early, because that makes sense, because he permeates quickly, right?
Yeah.
And this is before we even start talking about the actual mechanics, and the fact that he makes... So anytime anyone attacks one of your opponents... Or deals combat damage, so it doesn't even attack, succeeds at hitting one of your opponents. That reward of conflict is that they can pay a life to draw a card. Now, I love that is the fact that he played both sides of the Brothers' War against each other. He impregnated Urza's side, he impregnated Mishra's side way more effectively than Urza's side, but he got the two sides battling against each other, essentially like paving the way for the Phyrexian invasion that was to come in the future. And what I also like is the fact that obviously I'm a klepto. Obviously I like stealing things, especially in the game of Magic. You know, like that's just who I am, you know. And his last ability is you steal a bunch of shit from your opponent's library.
Yeah.
That's exactly what Gix does. Use your opponent's resources against them. Great. I mean, it's a little less nuanced, but God, it works for him as a character. So not only did I get a Gix after years of asking, but fuck me if he doesn't give me some steal effects in the game. Oh, he's going into my Satori deck. Oh, yes, boy. I've pre-ordered him. He's coming. He's on the way. He's going into the next, leaving immediately. Oh, stunning. Gix, baby.
Mark Rosewater definitely listens to this podcast.
I hope so. Hey, buddy.
Sorry, I said all that shit about unsets in the last couple of episodes.
Amazing. Yeah, Commander's the best format. Fight me. So Gix, really, really happy to see him. Glad he, not only his own card, but also the cards that are within the set all created this idea of menace, you know, like even I'm going to talk about in my honorable mentions about all of the commands, but I think there's one card, Visions of Phyrexia, and it kind of shows this idea of how Gix impregnated Mishra's mind and how that was like a big cause of everything that happened afterwards. Like, he was such an important character, and they didn't just give him one card, they gave him a random infiltrator, they gave him a skull flayer, a puppeteer, like everything was Gixy. I love it, fantastic. Thank you, couldn't ask for more.
Do you know, it's such a dream for me to listen and talk to you so passionately about cards that you love and a character.
Why do you do this for every... Why do you have such a preamble for every one of your picks?
And you've used the word impregnated so many times to such great effect, and it's just like you're... It's just... It's like I'm in the presence of a real master, and that's why it sets me up for my next flavor pick, which is Prototype. Because all of the prototype cards in this set are big fucking robots.
Big robots, bitches.
18 1/8 cards with the new mechanic Prototype written on them. Prototype reads as follows. Prototype, you may cast this spell with different mana cost, color, and size. I almost thought that was poorly worded then, but it's not.
It is poorly worded. You're not wrong.
It keeps its abilities and types. So, for example, Woodcaller Automaton is a 10 colorless mana artifact creature construct for 8/8. And it says, when Woodcaller Automaton enters the battlefield, if you cast it, untap target land you control, it becomes a tree folk creature with haste and power and toughness equal to Woodcaller Automaton's power and toughness. It's still a land. I picked the wordiest one. I don't know why. It has a prototype box, though, on it, which reads, you may cast it this spell with a different mana cost, color, and size. It keeps the abilities of the types. And it's two, instead of 10 mana for an 8/8, it's two generic green. I'm on my fourth beer. I'm very gassy. For a 3/3. And then that obviously trickles down the rest of its abilities with the same text box and said 3/3 instead of 8/8. So you get a 3/3 tree folk with base power and toughness instead of 8/8. And all of the different ones are the same sort of idea, so that permeates through. You get more basic ones like Rust Goliath, which is Reach and Trample for 10, which is a 10/10 for 10, like the last card. But for 5 mana, 3 generic, 2 green, it's a 3/5 Reach Trample. What's another good one? Oh, Boulder Branch Golem. When Boulder Branch Golem enters the battlefield, you gain life equal to its power, 7 mana for a 6/5, or 3 and a green for a 3/3. So it's a really nice sort of like scaling mechanic, and it also gives you the opportunity, from a gameplay perspective, purely from a gameplay perspective and not a flavor perspective, it gives you the opportunity to play these really cool cards if you haven't hit your land drops in whatever format. It doesn't matter what format you're playing. Like, even modern, that's a poor choice of words, even EDH or Commander as it's played now, sometimes you struggle to get to turn 7. Do you know what I mean? So you might not have 7.
Yeah, it's Modal, right? Things.
Modal, which is obviously where Magic's been going for a long time, but to see it in this context, where it's not Modal in terms of it's a different abilities, which is very cool, but it's Modal in terms of you get to play the cool robot sooner. It's just not quite as big. But if you just need a 3/3 with a cool ability, that's cool. If you pay more, you get a 10/10 with a cool ability, and you get the kind of props for playing the big thing. From a flavor perspective...
Yeah, do you get it now, or do you get it playing
later? Do you wait, right? Yeah. From a flavor perspective, the idea of these artificers and this big artifice war, not just Urza and Mishra, or Tornos, or Caleb and Krug, or any of these massive artificers, but all of the armies of artificers that work for these guys, constantly churning out designs, constantly trying to get the new best thing. And it's all the kind of, you know, it's the war games. It's like, do you get out loads of things really quickly that can just be really cannon quick. Fodder? Mm-hmm. Do you get the big thing that can smash through stuff? You need to show your new thing to your boss to make sure get it's mass production. And I really love the idea that the generic mana is always the original casting cost because it's pure artifice, right? It's that Power Stone thing we were talking about with Urza and Mishra. Whereas the prototype uses the colored mana because it's almost like it's not pure artifice. It's like you're using whatever resources you have to hand. That's how I'm reading it. So, you know, you have the people where it's like,
I also feel like it's more difficult to get it out sooner because it requires the colored mana, whereas you can easily get it out later because it requires no colored mana at all.
Yeah, I guess. I think that kind of tracks. But yeah, especially for the green ones, it works because a lot of the green ones have very specific nature-based sort of affinities, whereas the others are all like, you know, robots that do different things. So it's like they've used bits of wood here and there, or they've used the power of nature to kind of cobble together these things like a living weapon, like the Weatherlight, but maybe not quite as good, like a prototype of the Weatherlight. It fires on all cylinders. It boosts the gameplay. There's lots of card games that are coming out now, like things like Marvel Snap, for example. And the
God damn, have you seen those adverts?
The advert for Marvel Snap.
Are there more of them? They just cut everything that wasn't fun. Did you know
that's literally the line? That's exactly what I'm talking about. The guy goes, "We took everything that wasn't fun in card games and we cut it out." What they're talking about?
Not the advertisements, though. Did you? Didn't cut those out? You shit.
They're talking about mana systems. Having not played Marvel Snap, I completely know that that's.
It's the biggest thing against Magic, right? Is that we still have a intrinsic mana system which creates a diversity in gameplay that Hearthstone and every other modern game type doesn't have. Because it's rudimentary and it can hold back the game.
Yeah. So we're
in our 31st year. So what other game has that?
Yeah, I'm not trying to cast too much shade out of the card games, but that's the complaint that's levied, right? And that's why things like Hearthstone, it's like you get one extra resource per turn, and just kind of builds up that way with no matter what. Modal spells are really good for Magic because they do take that out. And this is, we know that, we've known this for ages. They've even done modal fucking lands, and you know, for like flip lands and all that kind of thing.
Everything.
The way that this
every
is done
card should have multiple functionality.
Yeah, the way that this is done flavorfully for this set, and also for us, there's 18 cards in prototype. Most sets don't even have 18 artifact creatures. These are just the artifact creatures with prototype, let alone all the other ones. And so, from a visual perspective, from a gameplay design perspective, having these cards be diverse with color mana symbols, not always popular in artifacts, but it works. Yeah. I just think it's a home run, great mechanic. Yeah. They should do it for every set.
Evergreen. I think it's quite nice at the fact that they also managed to make it so they're still colorless. So it still affects like Liberator and effects like that within the set, of where they're trying to create these circumstances of where the way you design it doesn't make it worse. It makes it more malleable. Like, it can be used in multiple functions. Like, okay, fine. They don't stand by like, oh, your blue spells cost one less.
Yeah.
So if you cast it for its prototype, it wouldn't be affected. I like the idea that they create these modal effects that you look at all of them and go, wow, it's a ridiculously expensive card. Like, how the hell would I... Like, I think a lot of people hearkened this set to be similar to, like, Rise of the Eldrazi, of where, how the hell am I supposed to consistently cast 11 cost creatures, you know, that have Annihilator 3 and stuff. It's like, well, you've got all of these random scions that not only sacrifice to make your spells cheaper because you can use them to cast spells, but also are there available for sacrificial fodder if someone attacks you with an Annihilator thing. Like, I think Rise of the Eldrazi is considered to be, if you haven't played back then, you won't necessarily know, but I played during that kind of era of Magic, and it was one of the best limited sets ever in terms of like how it made a defender archetype playable against 9/9 Annihilator 3s. You know, like, it's a really, really good example of how I feel like they're kind of going, how can we make cards be relevant early and late in a mechanical point of view? You know, like, oh, we rush the design of it, you know. And there's even cards within the set, there's a card, a white card from Urza, that says, I don't want you to make something pretty, I want you to make something functional, increase the output. And that's the flavor text of it, and it's like mechanized production or something. That's not the card name, because that's a different card, but you know, that's the idea. Is it's translating this need for both brothers to be accelerating their production schedule to battle each other. And I feel like that's done really well. And then from a playing point of view, yeah, you have this card that's 8 mana in your hand, and you go, what the fuck am I going to do with this? Oh, wait, I can cast it for 4 mana. Yeah. Never mind, let's get it down, let's go. Yeah, I think there's something to be said that I know we're a flavor podcast, and we don't necessarily always talk about how, like, you know, what decks are winning, but sometimes the way a card plays is as important to its flavor as how it reads.
Oh, yeah, right? Well, that's the whole thing. That's the whole Mel versus Vorthos.
Yeah, and I also think it's really interesting that most of these big prototypes aren't listed as constructs. I think all of these are listed as the creature type that it's supposed to be trying to be. You know, yes. So Arcane Proxy has prototype, it's a wizard. Whereas Clay Champion, for example, doesn't have prototype and is a construct. And I think that's a really interesting point of view for from a type line mechanical design point, is that they didn't want a lot of the prototypes just to be random constructs. I think they wanted the prototype to be like, you're making a Phyrexian worm, you're making an angel, you're making an ape. It just happens to be an artifact creature version of that creature type, which I think is really important.
I do as well. I need to pee because I've had some beers. Before I go for a pee, shout out again to Arcane Proxy, not only for being a wizard, but for being a mech with a cape.
No cakes!
Strong choice from Kakai Kataki, who's done quite a few artworks in this artwork, and Kakai Kataki is fucking wicked.
Who designed that cape? That's my question. What? I mean, you're probably going to cut this out because you're going, and you haven't stopped the record. So this is just, oh shit. Okay, right. So FYI, listeners, this is Nathan at like 10:40 on a, what day is it? Tuesday. Yeah, I've drank a fair amount of rum and beer, so we're on like after hours. I'm not sure if any of this is going to be cut. Probably most of it's going to be cut. But who the fuck was the tailor to an artifact? You know, 7/4/3. Who decided they could make a cape for an artifact creature? Who made the spear for the Clay Champion? You know? Like, that's a big ass spear, if you think about it. You've got this little dude next to him. Like, clearly this spear's like 3 times, that's like an 18-foot spear. Who's designing that? You know? I have questions. I have a lot of questions when it comes to like these kind of artifacts and things. Still Seraph, for example. You know, the flying angel artifact creature, you know? Like, I mean, that's basically just a Gundam. That's just basically an Evangelion. How is it flying? How do they justify that? They don't. They just expect you to accept it. And I don't. And then also you've got this big question, right? So you've got these big fucking artifact dudes, and then, yeah, the Phyrexian Dragon Engine is just a 2/2 with double strike. Doesn't fucking survive any of this shit. How is that supposed to be the most intimidating thing? That, you know, the Mac Fowler that fucking melds with Mishra, you know, and is the thing that makes Urza spark. How is that intimidating? It's a 2/2. Urza himself could take on the 2/2. You know, that's a flavor fail in my mind. If nothing else from this rant gets kept in the episode, I feel like the 2/2 double striking Phyrexian Dragon Engine is an absolute flavor fail. Artifact creature type Phyrexian Dragon 2/2. Go fuck yourself, wizards. Anyway,
I don't know if I will keep this. Well done for ranting all the way through me peeing. I'll listen back to it and I'll see how offensive you are to literally everyone.
It's me, you know.
we will see. Cool, that's me done. What's your next one? Do you have a next one?
I don't have an official one. I have my last honourable mention because you already spoke. I mean, that's a lie. I have one quick one and then an honourable mention that's a little bit longer. I wanted to mention the basics, but you did already. The other one that I had that kind of flagged up was that Hercule, Master Wizard. Now, what really annoys me, right, is in this set, there are very few wizards because there weren't wizards during this time. Now, Hercule, Master Wizard, literally in the name, is a legendary creature, human wizard advisor. What the fuck were you thinking when you make one of the only wizards in lore of this time an advisor? When there's only like 6 or 7 other wizards in the entire set. Most of them are like linked to the third path. One of them's a random dwarf artificer. Could have just been an artificer. Made him a wizard for no reason. The other wizards are very obviously clearly part of the third path where they're discovering magic. And yet you make the Master Wizard an advisor. What are they advising? Anyway, really cool mechanical thing. I like the fact at the beginning of your end step, if you've cast a non-creature spell this turn, reveal the top 5 cards of your library. For each card type among non-creature spells you've cast this turn, you may put a card of the same type into your hand on the rest of the bottom of your library in any order. What that basically means is, if you cast an instant, you look at the top 5, you put an instant in your hand at the end of the turn. If you cast an instant and a sorcery, you put an instant and a sorcery of those top 5 into your hand. Same for artifacts, same for enchantments, same for planeswalker. Cool. Really awesome. Annoying thing, back then, artifacts don't really count towards that because that's artifice, so it doesn't really count as a non-creature spell, really, in my books. Planeswalkers, Urza was the first one. Urza didn't happen until the end of the story arc anyway, so kind of flavor fail that regard. But I do like the fact that the newer the magic, the better the knowledge, right? So anytime you cast an instant or a sorcery and Hercule's in play, she goes, oh, that's a new form of magic that I've never seen before. And then, if you know, she then scries the top 5 and goes, oh, that's another form of magic that links to that form of magic. Put that into your hand and cast it. Kind of cool. Really cool. I really want to use her as a commander in the future anyway. I just think at that point, you kind of sacrifice the flavor of the character for the mechanical, I don't know, broad scope of her functionality, you know? Mm. It doesn't make sense that she triggers off of planeswalkers because planeswalkers didn't exist. It doesn't really, you know, work that she triggers off of artifacts because artifacts weren't really considered to be the same as magic. You know, they were part of the first/second path, being Urza and Mishra, but she's of the third path. Beyond that, I think it's really cool that the more weird knowledge you use, the more knowledge she gains. I think that's a cool thing, you know? So that's my only other non-honorable mention pick.
Sure.
My honorable mention pick's a little bit longer, but I'll let you get to your last one.
Just to cap off on Hercule there, I really like the fact that they've got given an artwork that is of their own. Because one of the only other artworks we had from them from Old Magic was Hercule's Recall, which is the spell that they use to recall the dragon engines. And there's a version which is the dragon engines being recalled by Hercule's Recall. And then there's a version of Hercule herself. Now, I really like that artwork, but it does portray her wearing very little clothing and is quite male-gazy if you look at it in one way. It's the same sort of thing.
Research this.
It's the same sort of magic art where if you look at Rebecca Gay's artwork, where it's like high fantasy, but it's fantasy, you know, with like, you know, naked mermaids or druids or, you know, or dryads or whatever. It's that kind of school of fantasy where it's, you know, there is a little bit of eroticism to it, or there is a little bit of like the human form to it. Do you know what I mean? It's not explicit, but it's just.
Why are you showing her side boob? All that kind of thing.
Not to get too into it, because it's far be it from me. I think there are certain artworks that exist in the magic space where they are exploitative and they can be male gazy for the sake of it. And then there are artworks which is like, look, this was a fantasy style at the time. In context, it's actually not that bad. But what I'm happy for is that that's not the only representation of this character, and that other representations that we now have don't just focus on the fact that, hey, Hercule might have liked wearing robes with very little clothing on at some points in their time of being a person, but actually at other times they're also the Master Wizard of the Third Path. Do you know what I mean?
Sure. Like,
it shows a rounded character of a person as opposed to just
one-dimensional thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there we go. Like that's my little... That- high horse about the artwork there.
Sure. I also like the fact they reinterpreted the recall into the final meditation, which is also within the set, of where it bounces all non-land permanents and you end the turn, because you end up dying doing that thing of bouncing three Phyrexian dragon engines, which is a non-insignificant thing to do.
Yeah. So Hercule. Really wild, really cool.
Very, very, very strong mage, yeah.
Cool. My last full flavor pick, because Urza and Mishra, Kid Urza and Kid Mishra, as I'm calling them, were technically my first, and we spoke about that at length. I'm going for one of my artist picks. Now, I spoke at length about Dominic Meyer in the last flavor set, and also for all the other stuff that person, they are on fire. They are on absolute fire. And
in
this set,
put them out, please.
This set is no different. So I'm not going to talk about Dominic Meyer, because it's just so obvious that they are currently, I think genuinely, sorry Chris Rahn, sorry Wiley Becker, I think Dominic may be my current, at time of recording, favourite artist. And it is a rotating
roster. Hard to argue. It's hard to argue right now, though.
But, so I'm not going to focus on them in
Becker
this set.
Becker had a set off. They've not had an artwork in this set, whereas Dominic got the entire command cycle plus visions of Phyrexia, so hard to argue against that.
Instead, and I'm not going to talk about Kakai Kitake, I can never, that's such a tongue twister, because I've just mentioned them, but they're also having a stonker in this set. I am going to talk about, and I am going to apologise in advance, I'm going to phonetically spell it, say it, and it's just not how it is pronounced, but there we go. Liga Schmilsklein. Liga Schmilsklein. Oh, bloody hell. The artist who's done One with the Multiverse, Forging the Anchor, Lay Down Arms in this set. And previously, they did The Soul of Windgrace in Dominaria United. They've done Call of the Void, Dream Fracture. They've done a couple of arena exclusive cards, like the Graveyard
Explosive
Shift.
Singularity.
Yeah, Explosive Singularity.
Magma Opus.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Magma Opus. Yeah, exactly. Like, whatever. What are the other ones that are catchy? Electric Revelation from Midnight Hunt. Mm-hmm. This is an artist that's been around for a while now, Magic, but again, has been one that has not really caught my eye. I like Magma Opus. That one, that's a really cool card in my Prismari deck. It's just not. Sometimes my eye just doesn't drift down to the artist type line. And I don't know why, it just doesn't. But for some reason, Forging of the Anchor was the first one as I was scrolling through, being like, wow, this is just brilliant. Chosahili creating the anchor. And then One with the Multiverse in a very separate scroll, because they're both blue, the same section as Scryfall. I was like, oh my gosh, that's the same artist. And then when I was looking for them again, went back up to the white cards, Lay Down Arms. I was like, well, there we go. So, very cool artist. It's not a style I usually go for, because whilst it's not necessarily fantasy realism, there is a bit of stylization to it. It's not graphic-y in its depiction. It's still very, like, magic-y. And it's
filigree, right? If you're talking
about, there's
lots
of, like, big broad brushstrokes and, like, tendrils of mana going everywhere.
Swirlies kind of things. Swirlies being the official terminology of the gaming podcast.
Liga, your artwork is super swirly, and I like it.
Super
and
swirly.
I think, and much how, like, Liberator, Urza's Battlethopter, kind of made me nostalgic for, like, an aesthetic that I hadn't necessarily played before. I think what this does, especially with One with the Multiverse, actually, which depicts Urza transcending into a planeswalker, is just pure magic. It is magic, right? Well, that's why I was I think we mentioned this in an episode way, way, way back, where we were talking about, oh god, there's a black spell that had a necromancer using, like, green magic, and I can't remember the name of the card, god damn it, but it evokes that kind of thing. The point was the same then, where it's just, I like cards that just have people just straight up doing cool magic that's just very
cool
visceral.
Cool magic shit, right? That's what
it's like. How onomatopoeia, in sort of sound terms, is like, it sounds how it sounds. I like cards that look how it should look, how you feel it should look, right? And I think, a lot of League's art does that. And this set proves it, so yeah.
That's interesting, because that flows right into my normal mention, which is One with the Multiverse. nice. Man, I love these big ass blue spells. Omniscience, Enter the Infinite. Like, these are the kind of effects that make you do something so supremely broken mechanically. that the flavor that it's trying to convey is so accurately represented that it shows either a moment of exceptional magic infusion or expulsion. You know, like, there's one thing to, like, destroy everything with obliterate, right? You know, lands, creatures, enchantments, you know, like, artifacts and everything, but drawing your library or playing anything from your hand for free, or with one with a multiverse, six blue-blue enchantment, you may look at the top card of your library at any time. You may play lands and cast spells from the top of your library. We've seen this before. You know, that's future sight, fine. But once during each of your turns, you may cast one a spell from your hand or the top of your library without paying its mana cost. It's like a little combination of both, a future sight and omniscience. And it kind of feels like it's really hard to convey the moment of some legendary character becoming a planeswalker, right? We read this at the end of the chapters, right? We read, like, the moment, because it's kind of like left up to interpretation of whether or not Urza sparked whilst he saw Mishra as the dragon engine infusion, or whether he sparked as the Silex exploded, whether or not he did it before or after, you know, left up to a little bit of interpretation. Either way, at a certain point, Urza did become the first person that we know of to become one with the multiverse. And you get that feeling when you cast this spell, right? Like, the ability to look at the top card of your library and then be able to cast at least the top card for free. Bolas's Citadel is a really good example of this, right? In black, of where you go, I play this and I might go completely bananas.
Mm-hmm.
And you have no way to stop me. Omniscience, same thing. Enter the Infinite. I'm going to draw my entire fucking deck for 12 mana.
Necropotence. What are you going to do?
Necropote, like, there are only so many cards in Magic that make you feel untouchable in your power, in terms of, like, what you can do within the normal parameters of the game of Magic the Gathering. And I feel like one with the multiverse, the point of Urza's ascension should feel magnanimous. And this, as a spell, the fact it sits, it's not even a one-time effect, you know, until end of turn. It's the fact that you have this every turn is ridiculous. You get future sight and you get to cast something for free at every one of your turns.
Yeah.
Now, back in the day, they wouldn't have said only during your turn. They would have made this every turn and it would have been even more broken. And the fact that it's 8 mana might even be, I don't know if it's, like, by modern standards, you might, oh, again, using the modern terminology, by current standards, you might think that 8 mana is too much. But for what it does, 8 mana, I feel like, isn't even enough. Because if you cheat this out, you are doing stupid things in a random game of Magic. You know, like Prophet. I was around during Prophet of Kruphix time in Commander, right? You got to untap everything and play spells and play creatures at flash speed. I had a rune deck, Rune the Hidden, of the Hidden Realm or whatever, and it was like flashing, blinking stuff. I was taking two turns per everyone else's one turn.
That was one of the first Commander decks I ever played. Yeah.
Yep. And it's you
lent it to me, being like, disgusting. Hey, I'm playing this new format. You should check it out. Oh, no, figure, yeah. 100 cards.
And I played Gifts Ungiven in it without realizing it was illegal, where I had a perfect loop of Revelark, the clone that makes a copy of itself, Body Double, and I can't remember what the fourth piece was, but there was no combination of options that wouldn't end with me having an infinite loop of stuff going on. So yeah, this is the kind of spell, and it annoys me. The reason I bring it up is it annoys me they're always fucking blue. Like, Obliterate's really good, but just destroys everything. It doesn't have a permeating effect beyond winning the game. It just destroys everything. Yeah. Wrath of God is strong, but it just destroys all creatures. That's not that strong in the grand scheme of things, you know? Whereas one with the multiverse, all these big blue spells, Enter the Infinite, Omniscience, they all feel so overpowered, you know? And maybe that's the idea, is knowledge really is power, but it's quite interesting to see one with the multiverse and go, you didn't even need flavor text. Story spotlight, this is Urza ascending. Of course, it's ridiculous. It does amazing things. Of course, of course, of course.
Yeah,
I'm glad they can keep making these cards and make me feel like, holy fuck, Magic's a powerful game.
Yeah. It's kind of an interesting thought experiment that does the perfect flavor card need to have flavor text? Does flavor text make a card not good enough?
Can it ruin it sometimes? Can it make it a lot of times? I feel like some cards are boring generically, but then the flavor text you go, oh,
but yeah.
Because,
yeah, but that, does that mean, is that the flavor text propping it up? What I'm saying is, you just said there was one with the multiverse. It doesn't need flavor text because it's so flavorful in every other regard.
The mechanics make it. Yeah, but also it's three separate abilities, right? Could you do it with a single line of mechanical, all creatures have haste, no flavor text, you know,
that's
mass
a good hysteria
challenge. That's a really cool challenge, right? I feel like it gets harder and harder when you move outside of concepts of a single magic spell composed to, like, as opposed to, like, a creature, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
All right. Well, that's it.
That's it. Podcast over. Right, wrapped it up. 150 episodes in. Never have to make another one again. Magic the Favouring. Complete.
That didn't deserve a laugh. That's not as funny as you thought it was.
I know. Look, I'm several rums in. Okay, just like you can cut that. That's fine.
God, we you're should not gonna. Stop. We should stop talking about how much we've drunk. People are going to think we're weird. Anyway, I like that as a challenge. If anyone can find a magic card that they think is flavorfully perfect using only one line of ability text, please let us know. Send it to us via our Twitter at MTFlavoring or by email. MTFlavoring@gmail.com. My personal Twitter is at AndyManface. Nathan's, yours is?
At the Fox in the Moon.
Oh, gosh. Much like the last episode, we're not quite sure if Twitter has survived this silex known as Elon Musk. wielded by some dark and terrible
planes. Silex Musk. What a name.
Musk's silex. but, you know, wherever we are, probably still Twitter. We'll see. Let us know. I really enjoy this set. I opened up a bundle. I love a bundle. I've already sent out tweets about bundles. And it was a lot of fun. Some sets kind of come and go, even with just like eight set boosters and a dice. And you just kind of go, whatever, I have no urge to. Sorry again, Dominaria United. Yet again, we're just bagging on you. I had no joy.
Sometimes you've got to take the hit. You can't release 18 sets a year and not have one of them be a dud.
Very
Maybe
true.
Your Bofa, you know, retrospective was accurate. Who knows?
God.
Hey, we've not talked about anything relative. We've not talked about any of the relevant shit. We've just talked about our own directives, you know.
Well, is it relevant or is it just it's just Twitter?
Does it matter? That's the thing. Is it relevant? Yes. Does it matter? No. We're playing the game. You're playing the game.
But I really enjoyed opening up Brothers War, so yes, I will be looking forward to opening it. Alright, anything more to say, Nathan?
Don't think so. Beautiful, stay sexy. Not just you, Andy, man, like everyone else out there.
Thank you so much for listening. This has been Magic the Flavoring.
We'll see you soon.